Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 320, recorded on Friday, November 3rd, 2017. Scott Galloway. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Storyblocks. Uncage your creativity. Get high-quality stock images for a fraction of the cost with Storyblocks. Go to storyblocks.com/triangulation to try it free for 7 days. Hello, welcome to Triangulation. I'm Jason Howell, and this is the show where we sit down with some of technology's brightest minds, awesome thinkers across the technology sphere, and kind of dive into some things that, at least as far as today is concerned, things that are really top of mind. We talk about, you know, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple. We talk about these companies on the network all the time. And it's really good to sit down with Scott Galloway, who is the NYU marketing professor and author of the book The Four, which I have right here. Although I apologize, Scott, because this book went camping with me and I have children. Yeah. So it is worn and there's a little bit of a scribble there where they thought it was a coloring book. But I read it. They didn't read it.
I like that. Good
Scott,
stuff.
Scott, it's really great to get you here to talk about this. It's called The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And it's just a fascinating read. Before we kind of dive into the content of the book itself, I thought we could start off with a little bit of background on you. Tell us about your time kind of working with consumer brands, and you founded Red Envelope. Tell us a little bit about all that.
Sure. So raised in Los Angeles, son of a single mother, product of big government, UCLA and Berkeley, started a company called Profit, a consulting firm focusing on brand strategy in the 90s that we sold to Dentsu, then started Red Envelope, a multi-channel e-commerce company. Day of the IPO, resigned from the board, decided to change my life, joined the faculty of NYU, or pursued a lifelong goal of teaching, and have taught on the faculty for 15 years, digital marketing and brand strategy to second year students. And then in 2010, started an accidental, or kind of fell into an accidental business called L2, where we benchmark brands' digital competence, and we work with 28 of the 100 largest consumer brands in the world.
Wow. And I know the work that you're doing with L2 in particular, but also kind of your experience with Red Envelope, that was consumed by the Amazon machine, as you put it in the book.
Yeah.
Considering what you're writing about in The Four, would you say that these experiences made you bitter at all about kind of the ambitions of big tech?
No, I think that I've actually personally benefited from this era of big tech, and I work with most or all of these companies, and I've been a huge beneficiary of this age, and these companies love their products. So no, I don't resent them. Also, I think in terms of Red Envelope, its ascent and its demise, I can blame the man in the mirror. I had as much to do with its success and its failure as anybody else. So I don't think I can blame Amazon for that.
Yeah, understood. But it certainly helps to inform your perspectives on, well, in particular, you know, just on one count anyways, Amazon, but also the other three companies that you write about in here. We're going to dive pretty deep into these over the course of the next hour or so. You say in the book, it's never been easier to be a billionaire, but it's never been harder to be a millionaire. I'm curious if you could explain that, kind of unpack that a little bit. What do you mean by that?
Sure. When I went to business school, we all kind of came out of the high school and made $70,000, $80,000, or $90,000 a year. And then a few years later, most of us were making kind of low hundreds. And now with these incredible platforms and fluidity of capital, both human and financial, and the ability of a company to scale as quickly as it can, you can scale a company faster, and people who are smart enough to tap into those companies and help them grow can scale their economic well-being faster. It's just unprecedented, the wealth that can be aggregated now. At the same time, while the economy is growing, it's not growing that fast. So the oxygen that gets sucked out of the room is for the people who are kind of average to good, which is most of us. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to just sort of be a solid citizen and make money and put money aside and become, hopefully over the course of your lifetime, save seven figures. So in my class, I'll teach 300-400 students a year. There's someone in that class who will be a billionaire, either through hedge funds or a tech company. But I also think a quarter to a third of them will end up dependent upon their parents or the government, because we are, you know, we're kind of hollowing out the middle. It's a great time to be remarkable. There's never been better opportunities if you're great at what you do. But if you're just average, it's never been a worse time, because the rest of the world, you know, wants their piece of the pie. And average is getting killed. Average can be ported and outsourced, and the cost pressure on average or even good is incredible, whereas remarkable, people find you and you have tremendous opportunities and you can just make the jump to hyperspace in terms of your opportunity set and your economics. So, and we see this across everything. The top 1% have captured 90% of the income gains since the Great Recession. So it's never been easier to be a billionaire, never been harder to be a millionaire.
Well, and especially when you're talking about these companies in particular, the money that they command compared to the amount of actual employees that they have responsible for all of that money. It's, you know, I guess you compare it to other industries and it would equal that sort of success, but spread amongst a whole lot more people than what you see in technology. It's a small amount of people creating these tools that everybody is benefiting from. They're benefiting from that monetarily, but that doesn't leave a lot for anyone else.
Yeah, if you look at the four companies, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, Jason, the total employment there is about 700,000. And that's because about 500,000 of them are from Amazon. And most of those employees are in the back end working in warehouses and fulfillment. But still, 700,000 people, that's about the population of the Lower East Side in Manhattan. And yet the combined market capitalization of these companies is equivalent to the GDP of India. So you have the population of the Lower East Side in Manhattan, and you have the economic value creation of the GDP of India, which just gives you a sense for the wealth that's been created and is being divided up among a fairly small populace. Facebook, well, let's back up. Intel, very efficient capital, 105,000 middle-class families, affluent families, $150 billion market cap. Unilever, about this 130,000 households being supported by Unilever, about $150 or $160 billion in market cap. Facebook, $470 billion in market cap and 24,000 employees. And it gets even worse than that. Uber has figured out a way with basically kind of a two-tier employment system where they have 2.1 million, quote-unquote, partner drivers, which is Latin for people who don't get health benefits or get to share in the equity upside. Right. Uber most recently was valued at $70 billion, which is approximately the valuation of Airbus, and yet it's managed to do that with 12,000 employees. It had 8,000 last year. So not only do we see this sort of wild income inequality, if you will, or this incredible concentration of wealth, but we now have our unicorns figuring out ways to kind of shrink the pool of people that get to participate in these enormous valuations.
Wow. And I mean, you know, when you're talking about a company like Uber, then they have to balance that with their, you know, other aspects of mismanagement that might shear away some of that value. That's an aspect that they I think are learning that lesson right now. The book really focuses on four. You call them the four. In fact, you dub them the four horsemen. That's Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. And we can get into them in a second. But you see these companies as, well, I don't know. Actually, this is a question. Do you see them as with the four horsemen as companies that are bringing with them some sort of like apocalyptic event as their power, or their influence grows over time?
No, I would say net, I think these companies are good for us. I love their products. I'm a big fan of capitalism, the system within which these firms thrive. I've done really well. And I think capitalism, as Winston Churchill said, is the worst system out there except for all the rest. I think it's the best in the world. And what I would argue, though, is that their influence and more really the personification we have of these companies and the amount of goodwill we feel towards them has resulted in a game, this game of capitalism, where there's certain teams, specifically these teams, that get eight tries at a first down. I don't think these companies are subject to the same scrutiny as other firms. They dominate the first page of every business section. We, in addition to loving our products, elect officials that are somewhat remiss to apply, I think, antitrust concerns to these companies. Mm-hmm. They have tremendously well-oiled machines around lobbying. They present a very progressive sort of friendly image to stave off what I would think would be regulation if they were seen as is who they are, and that is very, very competitive, very powerful companies that use all the resources within their power to make sure their earnings go up. And I think in general, we've kind of, if you will, if there's anyone at fault here, it's us, and that is we don't realize these companies are for-profit companies. They're not they're not concerned with the condition of our soul. They're not going to take care of us when we get older. They're going to every quarter try and use every asset at their disposal to grow their earnings. And I find it just strange that we don't hold them to the same set of standards that we hold the rest of business.
Yeah, and you know, part of that is the kind of give and take of it all, right? Like, and this comes up time and time again with technology, and especially these companies, especially Google and Facebook, I would argue, maybe more than the other two, is that we're willing to give a lot, more than we've ever given before, because of this extra convenience or this extra connection that we get in return. And I think that what I've been thinking about in the past few years especially is that trade-off worth it? Am I okay with giving that and getting what I get in return? Is it an equitable transaction? I think a lot of people are kind of thinking that right now.
Yeah, you know, and you're going to forget more about this than I'm ever going to know. But when you're not paying for a product, it means the product is you. So people are now talking about, all right, if I'm the lowest paid journalist in the world putting out stuff and they're running advertising against the content I'm creating, do I have a right to participate in the upside there? But I think what the majority of us have decided is the utility we get from these products is worth the data we give them and even potentially worth the risk in terms of privacy. Privacy is something. Whenever you hear someone talking about privacy concerns, there's a decent chance it's going to be someone over the age of 40 who's in Washington or Brussels. Young people, in terms of their behavior, seem to be very comfortable giving up their privacy in exchange for utility, which is what these companies offer. We've all had that creepy moment when we're at an Adele concert or something and a Facebook ad comes up for the Adele album. And you think, wow, the mic must be on in the app and they've figured out a way to understand where I am and serve me really relevant ads. And for the most part, our behavior is we would rather give up some privacy in exchange for relevance. We don't mind that Uber knows where we are and where we're going and is tracking it in exchange for helping the car find us more easily and get to where we are and tell us how long it's going to take to get there. But, you know, it's what I would argue is that I don't think regulators and I don't think we as a citizenry are putting in place the checks to support our government to do what they're supposed to do, and that is put on a referee's uniform and in an unbiased way hold these firms accountable and make sure that rule of law and that they're playing by the rules. I think these companies get the mother of all hall passes when it comes to anti-competitive behavior and just how incredibly powerful they are.
Yeah, and you say in the book, you say the four avoid taxes, they invade privacy, they destroy jobs, all to increase profits simply because they can. There's got to be a tipping point at some point, right? I mean, there's got to be some point where that crosses or where the younger generation that right now is okay giving up all this information may realize at some point, hey, wait a minute, maybe it's better to retract because we didn't see this coming, whatever this
is. So we may have hit that tipping point on from a government or perception standpoint. So a year ago, kind of the argument about these companies, which CEO is more Christ-like are going to run for president. And now, especially with some of the perception of bad behavior coming out of Uber, and I would argue the tipping point, if you will, was the weaponization of Facebook and Google by the intelligence unit of the Russian government. That seemed to really get people angry, at least the officials. But if you look at if we're waiting for consumers to vote, we're going to be waiting a long time. Because if you look at the results of all four of these companies, there is absolutely no evidence other than that consumers continue to increase their usage of these companies. So it's a bit of a tale of two cities. Yeah, governments are getting worried. People talk a big game about how concerned they are. But from a consumer standpoint, it doesn't seem as if there is anything slowing these companies down right now.
Yeah, it really does. Before we kind of dive into each of the companies, I thought we'd take a little time on each of them and kind of talk a little bit about what you dive into in your book. I'm curious to know how you use these brands that you write about. Does being super, hyper aware of the content that you've researched here and that your life work is all around invested into, I mean, does that change how you use these products when you compare it to like the average everyday user?
You know, I think you're overestimating me. So I'm a marketing professor, but I'm we were just trying to set up Skype, and I have trouble setting up a Skype call. I love their products. I would say that from a personal standpoint, I'm a little bit more aware of maybe some of the dangers here. You know, if you want to talk about the mother of all hacks that would literally create social chaos, imagine a hack. And let's assume, and it's not a bad assumption, that every organization eventually gets hacked, right? Because that's what it appears we're on a trajectory for. And what would happen if Google got hacked and everybody's face and name was above everything they typed into the Google query box? And then someone was able to put some artificial intelligence on that. They could pretty accurately figure out who's planning on divorcing their spouse, who is being unfaithful, who is planning to sue their business partners, who, you know, what diseases are do you have? What diseases are you worried about exposing yourself to? I think we would literally have social chaos. People don't fully understand that they have given, they have placed in Google the faith they place in God. And that is, they let Google in on their most secret thoughts and their most secret desires, their most secret curiosities, their most secret fetishes. And they trust Google with that information and trust that Google will give them an answer or highlight or compliment or illuminate that information. And so the notion that what if God got hacked and would started telling everybody what exactly you're thinking. And it's not even what you're thinking, it's sort of what you're intending. So it's even scarier. So I think now I'm a little, I would say, more cognizant of the things I put into Google, although, I mean, a longer conversation. And just personally, I think of myself as a patriot. At the end of the day, I'm a little bit pissed off at Facebook. I don't think they've taken responsibility and responded to this whole Russia mess with a series of half measures and denials. Although, to be fair, in the last few days, it looks like they're starting to get there. But Apple, I love their products. I think that's an incredible company, incredible design, great self-expressive benefit. I think Apple products are the new way that you say you have good genes and are a worthy mate. And that's how they've been able to achieve operating margins somewhere between an Hermes and a Ferrari. And then with respect to Amazon, I think they do an incredible job. They're the number one recruiter of students out of my class, which I'm grateful for. Fantastic at what they do. Whether they're good for the economy, in the long run, we'll see. We've seen job destruction like this before. We've just never seen companies as good at it. I would argue it's a love-hate relationship, but it's mostly love. The media and the reviews on my book focus in on the parts where I'm critical. But for the most part, if you, as you've done, read the book, I'm in awe of these companies. I think we can all learn a lot from them.
Yeah, there is absolutely a lot to learn from them. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to dive into these companies piece by piece. But before that, let's thank the sponsor of today's episode. All right, we're going to thank the sponsor of today's episode, Triangulation, and that is Storyblocks. If you have a story to tell, that's what this is all about. You want quality graphics, and you can get those from Storyblocks. Whether you need images for your personal or business website, or maybe your social media, or your next creative project, you're covered. Storyblocks offers high-quality stock images for a fraction of the cost. You download all the stock your heart desires. They have a member library that you can dive into that includes 400,000 stunning photos, vectors, textures, icons. Like I said, you're covered no matter what you're doing here. Save on millions of additional marketplace images. Marketplace offers digital assets a la carte with prices as low as $3.99 for full usage rights of images and $49 for video. Artists, by the way, take home 100% of the sale price. All content is royalty free, so you can use it for commercial and personal projects. Use it as you like. It's yours. New images are added regularly, so there's always something fresh to download. And you definitely want to go in here and kind of poke around, because as you do, it's pretty easy to be kind of pulled into some of these images and, you start to think how you can use these. I know it's come in handy for some of the shows that we're doing here at Twit. We have some bumpers that we've run on All About Android that we pulled some assets out, and it's just a lot of fun. Really gets your imagination going. Storyblocks is a one-stop shop for all your stock media needs at a great value. Their content has been used by some of the world's largest companies, including NBC, National Geographic, Travel Channel, and Discovery Channel, to name a few. Go to storyblocks.com/triangulation And if you go there, you can try it for free for 7 days. That's storyblocks.com/triangulation to download anything from 400,000 images and unlock discounts on millions more. Check it out for yourself, and we thank Storyblocks for their support. All right, so Scott, I thought we'd kind of dive in piece by piece here and talk about the companies that I know we are all very familiar with for a number of different reasons. And I really appreciated how you broke down each company to their core strength, or rather the thing that we as users, as people who use their products, the thing that appeals to us or seems to appeal to us so much. With Apple, for instance, you say they are a luxury brand. That wasn't always the case, though. They weren't always the luxury brand or the brand that everybody had to have, a status symbol or whatever. When do you think it really kind of crossed that line from being just a computer product, a technology company, into being the luxury brand that we know today?
So Apple, in a genius decision, decided they no longer wanted to be the best house in a bad neighborhood, computer hardware, which is low margin and exceptionally competitive, that they wanted to be the best house and the best business in the world. And the best business in the world is not technology. If you take the Forbes 400 wealthiest people in the world and you take out inherited wealth and finance, the sector that's created more wealth and more billionaires is retail and luxury, appealing to people's irrational desire to be attractive to others so they can procreate, results in irrational decisions, which translates to incredible margins. The second wealthiest family in New York is the Lauders. The wealthiest man in Europe is Bernard Arnault. Number 2 and 3 are the Scions of H&M and Zara, which again help young people feel like better about themselves and hopefully more attractive to other mates. So Apple said, we're going to be a luxury brand. And the way you, the offering of a luxury brand, there's two benefits. You feel closer to God. We're used to going into places of worship to see beautiful chalices, frescoes, adorned people singing beautiful music, or you feel more attractive to the other sex. And so they decided, we're a luxury brand. And what do you have to do with a luxury brand? You have to have an iconic founder that personifies the brand. You have to have artisanship at the center of your products that make things beautiful. You have to have vertical distribution and control your distribution and build these temples to the brand. You have to do print advertising. You have to have, I mean, look at product launches. These aren't product launches. They're fashion shows, including supermodels, Christy Turlington, highlighting the product. This is literally a company that has torn a page from the playbook of luxury and has achieved the impossible. Jason, they're a company that is not only the low-cost leader, goes into the supply chain and secures components for the lowest price, but the premium price product. This is the equivalent of an auto brand that has the pricing or margins of Ferrari with the production volumes of Toyota. And as a result, Apple will do double the profits this quarter that Amazon has done in its entire history. IBM, Oracle, HP, you still combine all the profits of all those companies, you still don't get the profit of Apple. They have pulled off the impossible by becoming a luxury brand.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Today, of course, is the official kind of release of the iPhone X, which is their latest and greatest device, or so they would say. And I was on Twitter earlier this morning, and I saw a video that was snapped outside an Apple store, and everybody that was waiting in line, of course, because there were lines for this phone, was, you know, running in like a scene from Rocky. Everybody's applauding them, clapping, cheering them on. Yeah. Confirmation that they've made the right choice. That, you know, and when you talk about in the book, you draw the correlation between iPhone and sex and being, you know, being appealing and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. It just really reminded me of that particular scenario where it's confirmation for people who identify with that brand, and it's saying you made the right choice.
So I noticed neither of us are wearing watches, but people, especially men who wear very expensive watches, oftentimes, I think a third of them don't even wind them. What they're really saying is they're saying to potential mates that if you mate with me, your kids are more likely to survive than if you mate with someone wearing a Swatch watch, because I have the power and elegance to spend $11,000 on $1,800 worth of steel, plastic, and leather in a movements casing. And luxury items signal you have good genes and you're a worthy mate. The new signal that you have good genes is that you are part of the innovation class, you have an appreciation for design, and you're wealthy. Specifically, you have an Apple phone. If you go into wealthy neighborhoods and look at a mobile phone operating system, it's all New York, Manhattan, the wealthiest neighborhoods in every city light up all iOS. You go into the red states, you go into rural communities, lower income households, it's all Android. just as paying with a Discover card or having ad-supported Pandora says you have bad genes, do not mate with me. This says I have good genes, mate with me. And people will pay a lot of money and wait in line for a long time to feel more attractive and feel like they are part of the innovation class and that they are more likely to have a greater selection of mates. It goes, I think it goes very deep to our instincts.
How did Apple accomplish this, though? I mean, there's a level of worship almost that Apple enjoys. You know, kind of exactly what I was talking about with the video I saw. What did they do that other companies don't do nearly as well?
So Apple has created, and almost every study, no matter who it is, Interbrand, anybody else, that with the ranking of global brand equity, number one is always Apple. So the question is, how did Apple achieve this unbelievable halo that results in operating margins that you could, you know, simply put are irrational? And the one move, probably the one business decision that created more shareholder value than any decision in the world, if you ask people to name that, most people would say it was Apple's decision to launch an iPhone. And I would argue they have the brand correct, but the decision wrong. Apple's decision, so let's back up. Samsung analog, Samsung spends double what Apple spends on advertising adjusted for top line revenue growth. And you say, well, Apple's smarter. They must spend it on online marketing. No, they spend less than their competitors in online marketing. So the question is, what are they doing with the billions of dollars in capital? How are they reallocating their capital to create the strongest brand in the world? And the answer is, Steve Jobs asked his board to make this irrational, crazy decision and got license to reallocate $4 to $6 billion into stores. And now that sounds like conventional wisdom and it makes a lot of sense. But can you imagine in 2002, just coming out of the dot bomb when e-commerce was really starting to get steam and people were saying stores are dead, to go in and say, we're going to take billions of dollars out of traditional broadcast media, we're going to take billions of dollars out of search and banner advertising, and we're going to open stores? But opening these temples to the brand where people actually consummate the relationship is incredibly powerful. And when you consummate the relationship with Apple in an Apple store, it's like having a first physical encounter with Tom Brady or Gisele. You're going to find everything they do funny and cute. You're going to find reasons to get along with their parents. When you have that first physical interaction with a Samsung phone, it's with a guy named Roy in a badly lit Verizon or AT&T store, and he is going to begin to bother you. And you're going to start thinking about having relationships with other brands, or you're going to be susceptible to it. So Apple's decision to forward integrate and create these unbelievable temples to the brand and take greater control of their distribution is probably the most value-creating business decision in history. You know, I work with a bunch of big brands, whether I don't care if you're P&G, Rolex, Nike, Samsung, they all have the same imperative over the next 10 years, and that's to take their percentage direct-to-consumer distribution or control distribution from 2 or 8 or 10% to 30 or 50%, or they will not be able to maintain those irrational margins. Show me a product being sold in Best Buy, and I'll show you a product that's not getting the margins of anything that's sold in an Apple store.
Yeah, no kidding. Well put. Now, another company that especially very recently has ambitions to have kind of an actual brick and mortar store. Maybe they have ambitions to kind of go the same route as Apple, although it seems a little bit different, is Amazon. You point out in the book that humans are really good at collecting goods. Amazon caters to kind of that human impulse to do that. And it reminds me of kind of like the impulse of gambling. Would you say that's a fair comparison, that Amazon appeals to the same kind of impulses that we have as other very addictive things in our lives?
So all of these companies are fantastic at building in very addictive components. Adam Alter, a colleague of mine at NYU Stern, wrote a fantastic book called Irresistible. But seeing, you know, I go on Amazon every day to see my Amazon book rank. And it's not seeing the rank that releases norepinephrine, but it's actually right before I see the rank. And what Amazon has done for authors is it's spliced literally the categories into millions of categories. So I feel fairly good that I'm number one in technology, information services, library services. And I'm number three in business, social media, economic history. And they've gamified it. And user reviews, incredibly gamified. So whether it's thumbs up, thumbs down, what Apple has done, all of these companies are outstanding at figuring out a way to tap into your lizard brain and get you addicted to to their products. Now, Amazon, you know, Amazon plays by an entirely different set of rules because it has reshaped the compact between investors and a company. Typically, a company has to show profitability after 2 or 3 years, and Amazon's been unprofitable or break even really for about 20. And as a result, it can reinvest 100 cents. The people waiting in that line at the Apple store today are going to give them a dollar, and they're going to get back 73 cents because Apple has 27 points operating margin. The people who are getting something from Amazon today are going to get 100 cents back on the dollar, which over time means that Amazon is going to catch almost any competitor because the product and the value is just better. And more for less is the ultimate business strategy that never goes out of style. It's the strategy of China. It's the strategy of Walmart. And now it's the strategy of Amazon. And the reason why I've predicted Amazon will be the most valuable company in the world and will be the first to hit a trillion, even though Apple's in striking distance right now, is because typically the most valuable company in the world is the company that is best at tapping into our need to have more. Jason, go home to your cupboards, go home to your closet. You have 10 to 100 times what you need, because the penalty for too little is starvation, which is the ailment that's killed more people than anything else. The penalty for too much is lethargy or diabetes, but there's a huge lag. And Amazon right now is the company doing a better job of tapping into our instincts of more.
Yeah, and instincts being also just the idea that this is literally, you think it, man, I really need this thing. Your instinct is to open up that browser and boom, 2 seconds later, you've placed the order. You don't have it immediately, but close enough, you have it tomorrow, and you probably get it without having to spend anything extra because you're probably already a Prime subscriber, which inspires you or pushes you to order even more through Amazon. And then, of course, recently, very recently, you had predicted that Amazon would acquire a brick and mortar store for years. You even predicted that they might buy Whole Foods, which they did not very long ago. How did you call that so succinctly? You were spot on. That's, everybody was touting that. So how did you know?
I got lucky. All the moons lined up. I was on a bunch of media the week before, and yeah, they kept saying, "You've been predicting Amazon's going to brick and mortar." There is no such thing as a successful e-commerce company. Pure play e-commerce does not work. Show me a pure play e-commerce company, and I'll show you a company that's either going to open stores or go out of business. Consumers don't live in isolation of any one medium. Very few companies have the access to nearly infinite capital of Amazon. I knew at some point they would have to go into brick and mortar, and people started asking who, and I said they should buy these 500 well-lit warehouses in unbelievable neighborhoods that have access to all these long tail brands called Whole Foods. And with Whole Foods, they now have permission to get into our refrigerators twice a week. Amazon's entire strategy, as I see it, I don't know this, I purposely don't have an open dialogue with Amazon because I don't want to be co-opted, or I don't want to start to like them. But you have basically a company that's figured out, how do we turn a traditionally non-recurring relationship retail into a recurring software-like business model? And the way they've done that is with Prime. And I think their entire strategy at the center of it is Prime. And they now have a recurring revenue relationship with 62% of American households. But you can't create intensity around a household without intimacy. And intimacy is a function of the number of times you have contact. And people are buying from Amazon, who even are Prime members, 2 or 3 times a month. But the only way you get them to once or twice a week is through the largest consumer category in the world, and that's grocery. And now with Whole Foods, they have access into our refrigerators once or twice a week. Whole Foods is about to become the grocery equivalent of a Mercedes for the price of Toyota. Amazon is going to overlay their operational excellence, and more importantly, their 0% ROI hurdle rate. And you're about to see prices get a cut across the board. And all of us are going to have the one excuse for why we didn't shop at Whole Foods all the time taken off the table. And that is, it's too damn expensive. Well, guess what? It's about to become a lot less expensive. Whole Foods to Amazon is going to be what Instagram was to Facebook. It's going to be seen as probably the best acquisition of the last decade.
Fascinating. And you had even mentioned prior to the acquisition happening that they could even shut down all of those locations and convert them into straight up warehouses and still justify the price. Post acquisition, do you still believe that to be the case now that we kind of know do we know all the numbers? What the numbers ended up as? And would you still say that?
Yeah, $13 billion on a $450 billion market cap company. Everyone said they'd never made an acquisition over $1 billion. Zappos had been the biggest at $800 million. But on a dilutive level, it was about the same price because they only had to give up about 2 or 3%. So for 2 or 3% dilution, they save 10 or 20 years trying to figure out a warehouse with employees situated in these highly affluent, dense places. So they don't need to close them down, and they're not going to. But if they had intelligent, educated, trained employees and access to thousands of long-tail food brands, which is what we all want, you're not buying Kellogg's, you're not buying Yoplait yogurt, you're buying some cool kefir thing out of Brooklyn, or you seem like the kind of guy to me that loves craft brews. And Whole Foods has established all of these relationships and has the supply chain figured out to get it to a warehouse that's within 3 miles of the wealthiest people in the nation called a Whole Foods store. And the amount of time to set up those 500 warehouses and those relationships with those thousands of long-tail food brands and then figure out the distribution for all of that, that would take even Amazon. That would take, call it 6, 8, probably 10 years. So it was a 3% dilution to get intensity across all of these refrigerators with this setup of distribution, logistics, and supply chain relationships. Is that worth 2 or 3% dilution? Hands down. Even if they closed the stores tomorrow, I get giddy thinking about this from a corporate strategy standpoint. They could have paid $30 billion for this thing. I reached out to some of my CPG clients and said, you guys got to put together a consortium and put in a counter bid. And they said, well, why would we want to do that? And my first reason was, if these big brands don't start controlling the distribution and they're totally dependent upon Kroger's and bodegas and 7-Elevens, their brands are done. They're toast. You have to get better distribution, and Whole Foods is a fantastic point. So it would make sense just strategically to own this asset. And then they said, but we're not going to get it. Amazon has infinite capital, and they'll be able to outbid us. And my attitude was, well, damn straight, make them pay more. Start peeing on more fire hydrants and pushing Amazon back. I don't know how I went on this riff. Anyways, I think this was a fantastic acquisition for Amazon. Yeah. And I think it was the worst possible news in the world for other grocers. And by the way, so does the market. What happens in between the time Amazon acquired Whole Foods? The largest pure play grocer, Kroger's, declined 30% in between the time Amazon announced the acquisition of Whole Foods and when they closed it. And keep in mind, this is a company 1/11th the size of Kroger. Mm-hmm. The day they announced it, their stock went up by the amount of the purchase price of Whole Foods, and the market capitalization of the other grocers declined by the acquisition price. So Amazon has so much credibility in the markets right now, it can go shopping for companies on their competitors' credit card. They can announce an acquisition, and the competitors in that category have to pay for it because Amazon's market cap goes up and their competitors' goes down. We have never seen anything like this.
Yeah, and I'm sure more to come. Can you think of any other companies or industries that might be in Amazon's sight post-acquisition?
Oh, it's already happening, Jason. Look what happened just a couple weeks ago. Amazon sort of just hints they might go into the drugstore business.
Yep,
opening
yep.
bell. Mm-hmm. CVS and Walgreens, two largest drugstores, 4 and 5%. Lost somewhere between $5 and $10 billion in shareholder value just because Amazon looked at the category. And then by the end of the trading days, analysts said, well, wait, if it's bad for drugstores, might it be bad for manufacturers' brands in the drug business? And then Pfizer and GSK started hemorrhaging market cap. All of a sudden, Amazon is making hints around delivery, and FedEx and UPS are going down. I believe Amazon could take the value of any consumer stock in America down by 30% in 30 days with 30 press releases. If Amazon tomorrow started saying, or on Monday, said every day we're going to put out a press release talking about how our infrastructure, our 757s releasing, our tractor trailers, our warehouses, our operations, our supply chain, our artificial intelligence, that all of these things fit perfectly to overnight delivery, you would see the combined market cap of DHL, UPS, and FedEx go down $10 to $20 billion. Amazon can perform Jedi mind tricks, and that is it can look at a competitor and wish ill on it and begin inflicting pain without even touching it, without even competing against it. We've never seen anything like this.
And again, great way to put it. Okay, so moving on from Amazon, we've also got Google, of course. You write, and you said a little bit earlier, it's Google is almost like God, almost like a religion. And, you know, everybody has access to the internet. We have immediate access to information as a result of services like Google, but Google's the kind of the big representation of our immediate access to this information. Is Google replacing the role of this all-knowing God for people? And how did that come to be, do you think?
100%. Our advantage as a species is that our brain is huge and powerful. We have to expel babies when they're premature because the brain gets too big. And our brain is big enough to ask these really complicated, nuanced questions. How does space not end? Or why is there so much suffering in the world? We're sophisticated enough to ask very complicated questions, but our brain isn't strong enough to answer them. So we have always had super beings. There's been competition among them, but our species has always had an instinctive need to have a higher being to help us sort through these questions. And as societies or economies become more educated and affluent, dependence upon a super being, or specifically church attendance, goes down. Yet our modern day anxieties and questions grow, so there's a void for a super being, but more of a modern man or a scientist super being. And our modern man is God. 1 in 6 queries posed to Google have never been asked before in the history of mankind. What priest, scholar, rabbi, mentor, coach, boss has so much credibility that 1 in 6 questions posed to that person have never been asked before in the history of mankind? Jason, do you have kids?
I do. I have 2.
So any dad who's had kids, you have your world of stuff, you have your world of work, you have your world of friends, and then something comes off the rails with one of your kids. One of your kids gets sick or is having trouble at school, or you know, you get that weird call saying your kid's struggling with something, and your whole universe shrinks down to the planet of your kid, and you look up to the skies and you pray. You say, "Will my kid be all right?" And now it's symptoms and treatment of croup into the Google query box. When we really want answers, when we really want to know what our all-knowing, all-seeing God thinks, and we need an answer that we can trust more than anything, we turn to our modern man's God, Google. Look at everything you've typed into Google. You trust Google more than you trust your super being.
Now, so why do we trust Google so much? Like, obviously, it's providing information, so we get something out of that relationship, which is what we want. But Google is more than just a provider of information. It's a, you know, behemoth corporation filled with people that, I mean, do we trust the people behind Google? Why do we?
I don't know. I don't think we think much about the people. I don't think we really understand what's going on and how they do this.
Yeah.
We just know there's this little box available on our phones and on our computers, and we can type in a question, and it'll give us the best answer of any entity or person ever. I mean, what I believe that Google's core competence is that they have assembled the greatest concentration of IQ in the history of the world. I think it dwarfs anything there was no Russian spy agency, the Mossad, you know, the CIA, the Defense Department, whoever you want to pull together and say has a ton of IQ. Google's appreciation for deep thinking and their compensation and their appreciation in stock such that they can retain the brightest minds in the world has resulted in an ability to answer more questions, more queries, and our need for knowledge, our need for answers, our need for comfort, that is an insatiable desire. And there's one place in the world that we get that, and it's Google.
Yeah, and continually, like I've thought about this before, how Google's collection of this knowledge, you know, what we use Google for is access to all this knowledge. Well, at this point, it's nearly impossible for anyone to compete against that. Google has built it up over the years to be the place that you go for this, and they've done such a good job with how they've created the service around all of that information on the internet that there's nearly no way for a company to come in and take Google on its own turf. What would it take for a company to compete with Google head on, or is that impossible at this point, do you think?
So it's a really interesting question, because I agree with you. I think that the skills and technology they've aggregated and the lead and the brand awareness they have and the trust they have is really insurmountable at this point. But throughout history, what history shows is when guys like you and me say that, that immediately indicates they're about to go into structural decline. That the moment pundits and academics start saying a company is too dominant and can't be caught is about the time it's IBM in the early 80s or Walmart in the late 90s, and it starts going into structural decline. Having said that, the marketplace sees Google as being a little bit more vulnerable than the others because it's not as diversified. It has one product that accounts for 90% of its revenues and about 110 or 120% of its profits. So technically, Google's sort of one click away always from a competitor, whereas Apple has these stores that'll take Samsung or HP or Lenovo or Xiaomi 10 or 20 years to replicate. Amazon now has this physical infrastructure, this moat in terms of their fulfillment network with their warehouses. Facebook is probably also one that's a little bit more vulnerable. But if you take out Google's cash, it's trading at a multiple of earnings that is somewhat similar to a lot of CPG or consumer staples. So the market looks at Google as being, I think, most vulnerable because it says, at the end of the day, someone might be able to come up with a better mousetrap. It's also, in some ways, most vulnerable to regulation because it has 90% share, whereas all the others have much less share of their respective market. But Google now has a 90% share in most of the major markets of a business search that by dollar volume is bigger than the entire advertising market of any nation with the exception of U.S., and one company controls $9 and $10 in that sector.
Yeah, that seems to be its biggest threat, and we're seeing that in the EU. We're seeing that here in the U.S., obviously. We'll talk about the Senate hearings, if you don't mind, in a few minutes. But yeah, Google, more and more, it's easy to compare Google to being the modern day Microsoft, when Microsoft kind of hit these roadblocks and had to kind of change how it was doing business. And not to mention Google, it has its search, it has all of these other things, but all of these other things are really inconsequential when you compare it to search. And, that's where it's making, you know, pretty much all of its money at this point.
Yeah. They're not a one trick pony. They're a one trick thoroughbred, right? They've got this unbelievable core business. And the concern around Apple is that they used to have several different businesses, their hardware business, their iTunes business. But basically, it's become the iPhone and the Seven Dwarves. I mean, the iPhone is really the profit machine here. So Apple doesn't trade at the same multiple as some of these other guys. But, you know, they all have their vulnerabilities and their strengths. But personally, I don't see anything standing in between each of these guys and a $1 trillion market capitalization other than one, each other, and two, Washington and Brussels, and that is regulation. I just think all four of them have such momentum right now.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Well, the fourth, of course, is Facebook. And you say early on, would you say that they're the most successful thing or most popular thing, was it? I had it down here. Most successful thing in the history of mankind, which I would say is very true. The amount of users that Facebook has, so much of people's online existence revolves around their need to maintain their profile and keep communicating with other people through Facebook. So those large numbers of people are locked in the Facebook view of the world. Have we ever seen anything like this in another industry, something that had this much of a stranglehold on people's lives?
Yeah, sure. I believe most successful thing in the history of mankind. 2.1 billion people have a relationship. I don't know why I waved my phone there. 2.1 billion people have a meaningful relationship with Facebook. There are about 1.9 billion self-identified Christians on the planet. So the Facebook feed is more successful than communism, capitalism, Christianity, and it got there in 15 years. If you look at the top, 80% of our time on this thing is in-app. Six of the 10 top apps are Facebook. This isn't a phone. It's a delivery utility for Facebook. So, you know, this is a company that has some of the most, you know, three of the five fastest 0 to 100 million user products are owned by Facebook. So this is an extraordinarily successful company that has scaled or tapped into an instinct that I believe is our need to love others. We're caregivers at heart. Kids with good nutrition and poor affection don't do as well as kids with poor nutrition but good affection. And the number one indicator of your longevity, Jason, is how many people in your life do you love or specifically take care of. And our need to connect with people, our need to strengthen and catalyze and reinforce relationships is hugely important, and Facebook's done this genius job of helping us do that and tap into a very emotional side of our empathy with photos. So Facebook has allowed us to tap into this need to love others and stay on the planet longer, better than anybody. If you have millennial kids that work for you or in your household, if current trends continue before they die, they will have spent 2.5 years of their life with their face deep in a Facebook application.
Wow. I had not heard that one before. Startling, but I guess not surprising when I really kind of think about it. And also, you know, there's this idea that Facebook has all this information, has people dialed into it, but they also have, obviously, algorithms working on the back end. And they've been known to play around with those algorithms in a number of different ways. And one example, you know, kind of in a sense, toying with people's emotions, seeing what makes someone happier or sadder or that sort of stuff. Do you think it's right for them to do this? They're being entrusted with so much. Is it, or is that just kind of par for the course when you're playing in Facebook's world?
I think a lot of companies do this. I mean, whether it's a company trying to figure out what logo makes you hungrier or putting in additives or chemicals that are more addictive in soft drinks. I think everybody does this to some extent, but I think it's our regulatory agency's responsibility to ensure it doesn't get out of control. And as we saw this week, you know, when they employ the ability to pull together thousands of data points that will register what type of news you want such that they can serve it in your feed, which results in another click such that they can sell another impression advertising, but they couldn't connect the two dots of someone paying in rubles and someone buying political advertising. It seems that their allocation of resources around collecting money as opposed to protecting our democracy, if you will, that things have just gotten a little bit out of whack. So, but all these companies employ very addictive behavior, and as does every other company. I just, the scary thing is not that they're doing anything wrong. They're just better at it than everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And I think, one of the other aspects of this that scares me sometimes about kind of the power and the influence part of all these companies is that they're doing it now because they can. They're really good at it. But I wonder how much thought is put into the long-term ramification of this. If we all buy into it, if we all, share, what is that point down the line that we realize, oh, maybe that was not a very good idea, and I wish we had not done that? We're seeing little bits of that, obviously, with the Russian interference. The Senate hearings have wrapped up for this week anyways. And I know that you were following this. Obviously, it ties right into a lot of what you write about in the book. Was there anything that surprised you about the testimony from Google, Twitter, and Facebook from that?
So the summary was, these are very smart people. They basically sent people they poured honey on them and sent them hunting for bears. You knew these guys were just going to get the crap kicked out of them.
Yeah.
And it didn't disappoint. They read them the Riot Act. But the general strategy was to kind of minimize, say, of our, 100x content, less than 0.001 of this content was what we're referring to. And they used this kind of BS statement, "We must do better," which is Latin for "we want to be seen as acknowledging the problem, but we don't want to commit to actually fixing it." And in my view, in a crisis, there's only really – it's not the crisis that typically does the damage to the company itself. It's the response to the crisis that does the lasting harm. Martha Stewart didn't go to jail for insider trading. She went to jail for obstruction of justice or refusing to acknowledge that she had traded on insider information. And what you're seeing with Facebook – until just recently, as a slow-moving train wreck. And because they're seen, the perception is it's a series of half-denials and half-truths. Just last week, Sheryl Sandberg says we're not a media company, which is a lie. She's a very inspiring, intelligent woman. And the definition of a media company is pretty much Facebook, a company that creates original content, a company that runs advertising against it, at 90-plus points of margin, a medium that uses reach to influence people and sell advertising. I mean, they literally define what it is to be a media company. And for them to refuse to acknowledge they're a media company, for them to try and minimize, for them to say, start off and say, we're going to put 250 people against this thing. Mark Zuckerberg had an unbelievable opportunity here to go on camera and go gangster and say, I am not a global citizen. I am an American citizen. What happened here is outrageous. I'm ashamed, I'm horrified, and I am personally committing to doing whatever is required at any cost to make sure this it doesn't happen again. I am going gangster on anybody that tries to threaten our democracy, and he could have cauterized the problem. Instead, it was a series of half measures. Oh, wait, only 3 million impressions. Oh, no, 100 million impressions. Oh, wait, 137 million people were exposed to this content, and they've gone from 250 people to 1,000. They could hire 10,000 people, invest $500 million a year in artificial intelligence to help those 10,000 people identify, screen, and arrest controversial content and advertisers, and it would only dent their cash flow 5 or 10%. Instead, it's a series of half measures and anemic responses. This was an unbelievable opportunity missed and will go down as a case study in how not to handle a crisis.
And I mean, we did hear from Mark Zuckerberg who, you know, like you said, they didn't send the big wigs to this event, to the Senate hearings. They sent their lawyers for you know, I'm sure they had their reasons. Mark Zuckerberg did say that he, you know, that it's going to be costly, but he said Facebook plans to tackle the issue at the expense of some of its profit. Do you believe him? Do you believe that companies are going to make the right changes that they need to in order to address this threat in light of what we know?
Yeah, I think they have to. They're getting to the right decisions and right actions. The shame is that it took them so long. Yeah. They're not going to get any credit for it, and the damage has been done.
Right.
You know, a couple things really struck me at the hearings. At the end, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee basically said, "You're our front lines. We really need your help here." And I just thought, well, what if you had big oil in front of them or big tobacco or Ma Bell said, you know, "You're really important. We need your help." It's almost as if our government has said, "We're old white guys and we don't mm-hmm. get this stuff. Mm-hmm. We give up. We need your help." And for me, it was sort of the final acquiescence where basically they just folded and said, "We don't get it. You do. We're at your mercy. Please help us." I mean, the questions I would have asked would have been a little bit more aggressive. And that is, if a company can be weaponized by an intelligence unit of the Russian government and they can't guarantee to us here and now that it's going to stop, shouldn't we shut that firm down?
Right.
I mean, But we as a society are like, "Oh, no, that's unthinkable. These are our innovators. These are our Jesus Christ." Well, I'll tell you what. My viewpoint is if a company can't protect us from an adversary that is trying to sow chaos in our country, I think we should consider shutting the damn thing down. But none of them are talking that way.
And we can't be without our platform to share how we feel about things. Like, we can't possibly have our phone for anything else.
But look, if I just find this just crazy. Facebook lies to EU regulators and says it would be impossible. In the review of the WhatsApp acquisition, they say it would be impossible for us to share data between WhatsApp and the core platform Facebook. And the EU regulators approve the acquisition. And then, spoiler alert, 90 days post-acquisition, Facebook figures it out and starts sharing data between the largest messaging platform in the world and the largest social network in the world. And for good reason, Europeans are very, very sensitive about data and lists of people. They just don't – they have discomfort with that. So what do? They fine them $112 million, which is the equivalent of 0.6% of the acquisition price of $19 billion. So what we have told our elected officials to do – and be clear, it's our fault. We elected them – is to implicitly tell these companies that the shareholder-driven thing to do, the smart thing for Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Apple to do is to lie. Because if they do lie, they get things approved. And if they get caught, they get the equivalent of a 25-cent parking ticket on a meter that costs $100 every 15 minutes. And they're not at fault. If you set up the incentive systems for companies to lie and be aggressive, they're going to lie and be aggressive. These companies aren't going to take care of you and me, Jason, when we get older. They're not concerned with the condition of our soul. You just talked about whether or not they're worried this is going to be a good thing for the planet in the next 10 years. I think they're good people who think that way in their own time with their own personal money and their own personal attributes. But every 90 days, analysts aren't asking them if they're improving the world. They're asking them what their earnings were.
Yep, fair enough.
Every day, they try and recruit and retain new employees. You know, I'd like to think that people at Facebook and Google really want to change the world. I think they're good people. But at the end of the day, people go to work to create economic security for them and their families. And the vast majority of compensation at these firms is through equity. And the way you get your equity price up is to sell more clicks, to sell more ads, and to sell more phones and sell more connections. And so the notion that we should expect them to think about the long-term ramifications of our society is naive and probably unrealistic. That's the job of the people we put in office. And to be blunt, they're not doing their damn jobs.
That's what it seems like. Well put. So,
Why am I yelling?
I don't know. I love it though. Thank you for yelling.
You seem like a lovely guy. I don't know. I'm not yelling at you. I'm just yelling. I'm barking at the moon right now.
I know. I appreciate that you're yelling because, and to be completely honest, in talking with you in this interview and reading your words in the four, it's, I mean, obviously, in both cases, it's your voice, and it works here as well as here. I get the same vibe from you in person that I got out of some of the pages in the four, and that's what makes it a really compelling read, to be honest. So, Scott Galloway, really appreciate you taking the time to come on and talk a little bit about all the big tech companies and everything that you have inside your book, The Four. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for the platform and congratulations on your success, Jason.
Thank you. The4book.com if you want to go order it. Or, you know, you can go to that company that we were talking about earlier. You can probably go to Amazon and find it pretty easily. They do carry it. I'm sure they don't have a grudge against you for the book, right?
Not yet.
Not yet. We'll see what happens. Again, Scott Galloway, thank you and have a wonderful evening. We really appreciate it.
Likewise, boss.
All righty. We do this show every Friday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. If you want to join, you can actually watch this live. Go to twit.tv/live. You can tune in while we're recording it and check it out while we're here. If you don't catch it live, don't worry. We post it after the fact. twit.tv/TRI for triangulation. It posts in Monday every evening. Whatever interview we have on that day posts later in the evening. So you can subscribe to that and have it automatically download for you and you're taken care of. This was a wonderful episode today. I'm sure there are pieces that you probably want to go back and listen to again because there's really important stuff in here. So do that. And we will see you next week on another episode of Triangulation.